Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Good day and welcome to the December 2016 episode of The Three Horsemen. This will be a somewhat weird episode because we are going to be recording across time and space. So please welcome my fellow horseman for today, Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson11 on Twitter.
And please welcome our special guests. We'll start with Mr. John Anilio.
Hello, it's John Nelio, and we are also joined today by my co-host on the Functional Nerds, Patrick Hester. Patrick.
That bastard owes me money.
I don't owe you money. I don't think
no,
so.
Patrick
Hester owes him money.
Oh, that's right. That's right. This is a crossover episode. It's like, you know, when G.I. Joe and Transformers had that comic book
No. As Jeff Patterson will tell you, this is like when Power Pack crossed over with the frickin' X-Men.
Oh, who's Power Pack?
We are.
Oh, we are. We mentioned Power Pack enough on the show where I guess I can buy that.
Yeah.
Well, your Power Pack word of the Micronauts.
Ah,
your touche. Mask.
Oh, mask is good. Oh, you know, there's
they rebooted it.
I didn't know about the reboot, but I was just there's a great YouTube video of some dude like me who like went in and recorded, did one of those like song videos of the Mask theme where he's like playing the guitar and playing the keyboards and the drums and everything and doing the whole Mask theme song. So that is worth checking out.
I'm ATFMB on Twitter and John is John Anilio.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Like their thing, John. We're on their show too. Remember?
Oh, right. That's okay. Yeah.
I'm at Fred Kish on Twitter.
And how do you spell Kish?
The way everyone else does.
K-I-S-H?
Yeah.
Well,
give it a try. See what you get. But our relationship with Mr. Hester and Anilio go way back. I once recorded an episode of their podcast in a car in the middle of a rainstorm, as John will be able to attest to since he was one of the people there. And Patrick ran SF Signals podcast for years and years. And when he got too busy, that's when Jeff, John, Stevens and I stepped in to do a couple of guest shots, and that eventually became this podcast.
Which caused a whole ton of issues on the feeds once you guys decided to launch your own show separately. I don't know if you remember that whole fiasco.
Yes, I've entirely erased that from my memory.
iTunes was all, wait a minute. You already put these episodes out.
Yeah, iTunes. We love it. So Patrick was on one of our previous episodes this time of
year. Your first episode. That was your first episode ever of your podcast.
The separate podcast, but not the.
That was when you launched, right? I was your first guest.
Yeah, you were your first. You were our first guest after a Paul Weimer was our first guest. But we won't mention that. But you were on our first holiday show with a guest. How's that sound?
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
So because we had been talking amongst ourselves, we wanted to get John on the show at some point. If nothing else, to thank him for the fine work he did with the theme song that you heard at the top of the show. We wanted to get both of them
on. I'm curious, Fred. From the time that you requested a podcast theme from John until he delivered, how much time was that?
Less than 24 hours.
Wow.
Fully polished product.
Wow.
Within 15 seconds, he sent me a suggestion, and we loved it, and we just went from that. Why are you insinuating something differently?
No, I was just
no. It's that it took like 2 years for me to do one for our show. but they paid me, Patrick. So that's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
What do they call it? The cobbler's child's shoes, that kind of thing. You know, it's like it took me a while to come around. I had a lot of fun putting their theme song together because once. I don't know if Fred even or Jeff suggested the sort of musical theme, but it just sort of struck me as like, well, wouldn't it be funny if it was like one of those sort of spaghetti Western kind of kind of a thing, and can be all in one shot. And I recorded it over the course of a couple of days, and that was it. And it's sort of a creative thing that or lesson that one should learn is, even though I'm not all that active in putting out new songs these days, the podcast themes that I've done for SF Signal and for our own podcast and for
the Three,
I should be writing, you know, all those things,
Angry Robot,
all those things came together quickly. I recorded them real quickly. Didn't care too much about, like, I'm like, eh, it's good. It's fine. It's good. And any other song I ever do, I would like slave over every note over and over and over again. And, arguably, well, not even arguably, the podcast theme songs are the ones that are heard way more often than anything else I've done. Because if you listen to the podcast, you hear that damn song every week.
Well, yep. And back then, long time ago, when grass was green, I used to produce the I Should Be Writing podcast. Mm-hmm. And John created two versions of that song. There was the acoustic version that he put together really quickly, I think. And then there was the more production value version that had drums and electric guitar and stuff. I actually never liked the more production version of it. I always played the acoustic one. I always put that in front of I Should Be Writing.
Looking back on that, that was the right call, because I don't even like the produced version of that. One of those things where, you know, because I didn't end up recording that until I'd written the song and played it like acoustically many times before I got out to recording it. So the magic was lost. Mm. So it was that's like one of the few times the full version doesn't really work for me. I like the just straight guitar voice version of that, too. But enough about that Anelio's music.
So you guys together, I mean... I know, John, you appeared on a couple episodes of SF Signals podcast, but you're more well known as the Functional Nerd duo. So what episode are you guys up to at this point?
Oh, my God. We're about to hit 300.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what does that put me at, Fred? Like 600 between the two shows? I don't know.
Well, how many?
Makes me very tired.
How many podcast series do you edit at this point?
Only the one, thank God.
All right, so
I'm only doing Functional Nerds at this point.
But in the past, you did, as mentioned, I Should Be Writing and...
back in the day, again...
SF Signal.
Yeah, I was doing a solid 8 hours of editing on Sunday.
Oh.
Because I was... I was doing two episodes of I Should Be Writing. I was doing the interview episode and then MERS regular episode. I was doing two episodes of SF Signal. I was doing, again, our panel and then our interview. And then I was doing an episode of Functional Nerds. So basically, I would get up, get some coffee, and I would just start editing. And that's all I did on Sundays.
And MERS' show was like heavily edited, right? Because she would like not start. She could, because, and if you've ever tried to record yourself doing a podcast by yourself, that's nerve-wracking when you're not talking with anybody, because then you notice like you said something weird, so you start over and everything,
right?
And Mer would just like keep the tape rolling and be like, edit that out, Patrick.
No, what she would do is this.
Oh, she would snap her fingers.
Whenever I saw that or heard that or saw the spike, I knew that she was going to redo something. Or if I heard her daughter, Princess Fiona, basically going, "Sorry, Patrick." I knew that I would have to edit that out as well. Because there'd be whole times when Mer would be recording something and all of a sudden her kid and dogs would come rushing into the room and they would just be gabbing for a long time and just, you know, all this excitement. And then Mer would go, "You know that I'm recording, right?" And then you just hear this really quiet, "Sorry, Patrick."
That's excellent.
Yeah. So yeah, I did all that. What I'm now, I just have to edit Functional Nerds, which is great. And the difference that I have come up with is when I'm actually recording it, I almost always have my little notebook here, which I've just about filled up. No one can see this except the guys who are on the video. But like, I make all my little notes on this notebook as I'm going through, and then I go backwards and I do all my editing from the back to the front, and it's so much quicker.
Would that be Field Notes or Moleskine, or what brand do you prefer? Let's go into a different podcast entirely. Digital tools, analog tools.
This is actually one that I got at a digital summit, and it's just a nice little book. And I did just order Moleskine, the Moleskine or whatever you call them. So I got a couple of those on order from the Great and Powerful Oz or Amazon, whatever you want to call them.
Okay. Now, well.
I am launching, however, an audiobook production company. So if you want me to do your audiobook, send it my way.
And you also have something else coming out soon, don't you?
I thought we weren't going to talk about that, Fred. Oh, you meant the book.
Yes, the book. Yeah. The book, not the disease, the book.
Yeah, I do have a book coming out, Samantha Cain Into the Fire.
I may have read a version of that at one point.
You may have, yes. It's been heavily edited since because of all your notes.
Uh-oh. Okay. Well.
Yeah. Send Fred the space opera guy an urban fantasy and see what happens.
Hey.
Well, first of all, there's no spaceships in this, so forget that. But let's do some picking, man. Let's pick.
It's December. Pretty soon, if you haven't already, you'll be putting up your Festivus tree, or your Hogfather tree, or your Christmas tree, or your fill in the blank. So what does the good nerd want underneath the tree? So here we have the former experts from SF Signal who are currently on their separate ways gathered together again to help you empty your wallets.
Is this similar to what we used to do on SF Signal, Fred? Is that what you're going for here?
I only steal from the best, Patrick.
Okay.
So who would like to start, Patrick?
Oh, you want me to go? So in the vein of the old SF Signal stuff, I have to first pick the Socksmith men's and women's crew socks with bagel schmear graphics.
Don't you love when Patrick picks like food and stuff?
How long did you search on Google for that?
All of 20 seconds. But yeah, I mean they're like $10. They're perfect. They come for men and women, and you can get different sizes. But they have the nice bagel schmear on there. So
you could get that for Mr. and Mrs. DiNardo.
Yes, exactly.
There you go. That knocks two off your list right there.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
One time, Patrick picked fried chicken.
I did
on functional.
Well, notes. And those were oh my gosh, what's the they were tempura fried chicken. It was tempura batter, which was very different. It was very light. It wasn't greasy. It was very good.
And I feel like I was like not in a mood that week. And I feel like I was like, fried chicken, dude, really? Like we're picking fried chicken.
Yes.
I was so mad. But anyway, should I go next, Fred? Or
if we can get an actual pick, yes, please.
Oh, okay.
Wait, whoa.
All right. I'm gonna pick a book here. And the book I'm going to pick, which I hope these don't have to have been published or put out in this year. I hope
actually, it's between heavens. November 15th and December 12th.
Okay. All right.
That's the time frame.
So this was a book from 2015, and that is Zero World by Jason M. Huff. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I believe it's Huff. H-O-U-G-H. I loved this book. It's advertised as sort of a science fiction spy thriller, and it is that, but it's way more than that as well. And if I said why it's way more, it's kind of spoilery, so I don't want to get into it further than that. Other than that, if science fiction spy thriller sounds good to you, but you like deeper science fiction-y kinds of concepts into it, I would highly, highly recommend this. I did listen to the audiobook of this one. So if you are an audiobook listener, like as I'm sure many of the podcast listeners are right now, I would recommend the audiobook as well. And I believe this is one of those ones where if you bought the ebook, the audiobook is only like $3 or $4 kind of a deal. So if you get both of them, it's like under $10 for both the ebook and the audiobook.
I love those deals.
Yeah. So and I'm not sure if the ebook is still priced that low. It might be. I'm not sure, but it's certainly worth checking out for that deal. And it's just great and surprising, which maybe this might turn people off to it. So I don't know why I'm even mentioning this, but I'm friendly with Jason on Twitter and Facebook and all that. And when I was done with the book, I raved about it. And, you know, and he said, oh, thanks for reading the book. And I'm like, when is book two coming out? And he's like, there is no deal for book two yet. And I'm like, what? You know, so I have no idea why there is no deal for book two, because this can be a multi-book series easy. He like just scratched the surface on this world and this character. And I believe Del Rey published this book.
That might be why there's no book two.
Are they known for not putting out book twos and threes of things? Is that their...
You might say that on more, at least one occasion, if not more than one occasion, they basically eviscerated the entire middle markets of the paperback industry by saying, "Yep, we're not doing any of those anymore." So
yeah, well, I know.
I miss Fred.
Sorry. Yeah.
He said he misses you, Fred. Well, because I know Jason's. I think with this book too. I think there is now. It's in. I forget what it's called, but there is a TV/movie something going on with this book. Now he said, you know, it's early days, and a lot of times nothing happens
right
with those deals. But you would think Del Rey would be like, "Hey, man, we got a potential TV series out of this. Let's start pumping the books out."
If they have the rights for it, John. If it was something that was kept by his agent, they could not have anything to do with it and not care. It could be like Marvel and the X-Men movies. They don't give a shit.
Well, no. If anything, Marvel is doing their level best to sort of eradicate the X-Men.
Exactly.
From the, because they're just like, yeah, we don't want to like do, is it Fox who has
something like that?
The X-Men, yeah. So, but that is my opinion. It is an excellent book, even though there is no... plans for book two as of yet. I mean, in Jason's mind, I believe he's got it worked out, but hopefully there will be other books. But even on its own, it's great. So that is my pick, Zero World by Jason Huff.
Cool. All right, Jeff, would you like to go next, or should I toss
one in? Because my brain is completely shot and I cannot process dense information and am placated only by eye candy. John Byrne, who did X-Men and Fantastic Four and has been rather a sometimes controversial figure in comics for his opinions. Anyways, he decided to do a coloring book. And he's done John Byrne's Stowaway to the Stars, a graphic album to color. And he basically did 24 full-page illustrations that are dense on hardware and neat costumes and aliens and robots with a little story that goes with it. And it came out a couple weeks ago. And the images for it that have appeared online look spectacular. And it's actually on my list for this year. He did a lot of, you know, in-process samples on his forum that I was looking at. And I always loved when Byrne sort of went, you know, feet first into the into science fiction hardware and stuff like that, and a lot of intricate line work here, and it is definitely placating that need for really nice looking perhaps old school artwork. So
are you going to color it in?
Oh, I might.
On the grand tradition of comics, can't you like get two copies, one that you don't do anything with and one that you actually color?
Yeah, that's I think that's probably the strategy in marketing that thing. I'm also noticing that there is no digital version that one can run through Photoshop either. So
of course not. That would defeat the purpose.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I was going to start with a comic or a graphic work, but I will instead go gaming. Patrick, I know you do role-playing, right?
Yep.
And John Stevens does. I don't know if you do as well, John and Ilya. I think you're more a
more
an Xbox kind of-ish guy or whatever.
I just ran my first game in many, 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 many years.
Okay.
It's very interesting.
Well, for role-playing, Patrick, what happens if you are a character...
I'm a character.
Go through your adventures. What do you generally do? You get better at things or worse at things?
Depends on the things.
Well,
I get better at them.
Yeah, generally that's what happens in most games like D&D. You rise up through levels. You get better and better, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the game I'm going to recommend is one called Call of Cthulhu, which just came out with its 7th edition. And I first started playing this with the 1st edition, and it was groundbreaking at the time, and it's still pretty groundbreaking that as you get better at things, namely doing adventures, you also get worse at things. In other words, every time you encounter one of these horrors from the outer deeps, you lose a characteristic called sanity until you become insane.
Yep.
So I've run this face-to-face many times. I've run it online with people like Paul Weimer. Who? And other, well, former SF Signal people that you may or may not recall anymore. You know, the vast dims of past of time.
I've been thinking Paul should do a podcast. We need to talk to him about launching one.
He's on like 18 podcasts.
No, he's not.
To do one by himself.
No, he's not.
So KMuseum did a 7th edition, hardback, multi-volumes, and a beautiful slipcase. And I recommend it highly if you like Lovecraftian horror, if you like straight horror, if you like mysteries, if you like games that aren't just bang bang or slice and slice, it's definitely something that you should look at. And if nothing else, the artwork in these books, these new editions, are beautiful.
Well, you know, I play Elder Sign.
Oh, yeah, the board game version.
Yep. Yeah, I like that one. I've heard good things about Arkham Horror. It's just not about setting it up.
Because it takes you, what, 7 hours to set it up?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. The first version of Arkham Horror took about 30 seconds to set up. Mm. So.
If I may interject a very brief story that I think Patrick will find very amusing. A few months ago, Fred, myself, Rob Bedford, who is local, who writes reviews for Tor.com and other places, and Mike Martinez, who is the author of the Daedalus incident, who is also local to the tri-state area, we met up.
And
Shecky. What's Shecky's real name? Does he just like be calling Shecky? And it's Richard,
but I don't know if he uses that officially outside, so you know, I just always call him Shecky.
Yeah, we met up with Paul Weimer as he was on Paul Weimer's Excellent Adventure through our area, and we met up with him at a bar and had dinner. And Patrick, I think you'll so the people who were fans of the SF Signal podcast, and that's a lot of familiar faces. Patrick, when we all sat down at the table, Fred was one of the later people to arrive, and within 30 seconds, he patted my head like I was his 8-year-old nephew and fixed Paul Weimer's collar.
And gave everybody a hug, too.
Yes, he did that, too, but I enjoyed how he fixed the collar and patted my head.
And I told Paul to also to relax.
Yes, I believe you unbuttoned his top button.
Yes,
he had his top
button. Told him to relax.
Yes, so Fred.
Paul does need to relax a little bit. He's a character in his own right, and he just needs to relax. He's a great person. He has a lot to say, and he is so well read. He's read so much stuff, and I think that it just all tries to come out at the same time.
And Paul, we all love you.
We do. We absolutely do.
And I should also mention that Mike Martinez was kind enough to bring us some of the beer.
Oh, yes.
Which was quite good. I did drink it and had it, and it was very good. So, hang out with Mike Martinez. He writes cool books, and he brews his own beer. Yep. So there you go. I guess we're back to Patrick. Unless, Fred, did you have other thoughts about what you were talking about with your game in there?
Nope. I'm ready to actually hear something from Patrick other than bagels.
Oh. Okay. So John and I were just talking about this. One thing that I'm very excited about is Babylon's Ashes.
Mm-hmm.
This is book 5 from James S.A. Corey in The Expanse. It just launched here in December, and the audiobook is up. Jefferson Mays is reading it again, which is good because that means that I can listen to it. If it was the other guy, I was going to have to track down Ty and Daniel and have a very difficult conversation with them. Because that other guy sucked.
So how many were done by the other guy?
One, and then all the novellas.
Ah, okay.
And it's not good. It's such... One of the things that writers talk about a lot is being jarred. Especially in a critique group, someone will say, "Oh, this section jarred me out of the story." That dude totally jarred me out of the story. I'm like, "What? Who the hell is this?" It's like there are, I think there are 74 Dresden Files books at this point, and all of them except one was read by Spike.
Right.
And everybody hates the one that Spike didn't read.
I thought they were re-recording that one.
They were, and I think they may have already re-recorded it. So, but yeah, that's the whole thing. It's like when it's not that voice that you're used to, it throws you completely. Because Jefferson Mays did such a good job of bringing those characters to life. And Abisarla, for example, is a great character. And the other guy read her as like a Southern Belle. What?
No.
You think they'll re-record that one with Jefferson?
I would hope, but there's lots of rights and money involved.
Yeah.
And,
you might, though, because now with the TV series and everything, those books are only going to get more popular. And, you know, and that is, I hear it from everybody who listens to that audio
book. Like, you want to skip that book, but you can't because you need to move forward. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is very cool. My pick next, this is an interesting experiment that I ran for myself, which I think many people can do. I just read a couple months ago a book that came out 10 years ago, and that is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. It depends.
Mr. Norrell!
So Patrick obviously saw the BBC show, yep, I'm assuming.
So did I.
And so this was one of those ones where this was a Kindle Daily deal a million years ago, and I bought it for $2 and it sat on my Kindle, and I know it's a long book. So I was like, I'll get to it eventually. And then I saw that the show, the BBC show, appeared on Netflix, and I'm like, and it's one of the podcasts I listen to picked the show, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to read it.
The show years ago.
It only came out a couple years ago, right? Like 2 years ago, something like that.
I picked it at that time.
Yeah. So I did decide to read it. And this is my advice to people for reading it, because I actually really ended up liking it quite a bit. Know that it's a long book, especially if you're reading it as an ebook. And just nowadays, I read 3 or 4 books at the same time between ebooks and audiobooks and, print books and everything else. I always got like 3 books going at a time. Have more than one book going. Read it. Don't try to plow through it. Just take your time with it, because that's kind of how the book is paced. It's very, leisurely, I suppose, is a way to put it. But it's great.
Very British.
Yeah, it's very British. I liked that about it. I liked that it was so different, and that it was so, it took its time, and I enjoyed the book a lot. And this series, if you watch the series, pretty now I started watching the series the night that I finished the book, so the book was fresh in my mind. So the series hews pretty close to the book, I have to say. There's a couple of differences, of course, as you can imagine, but there are scenes that are like almost word for word out of the book.
I think the series did some parts better than the book did, like that first bit of magic in the church. Where the statues come to life, I thought that just seemed so much better than how it was described in the book.
Well, and Timmy Tay is in it.
Who's Timmy Tay?
Timmy Tay from The Hogfather.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen The Hogfather, so sorry about that. But
it's a Christmas tradition.
I know, but but it was well cast. I bought all the actors in those roles. And if anything, this series, the television series, cleared some things up for me, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to. I'm like, because if you are reading it slow, you can miss certain things.
I want to say it's like a 30-hour audiobook.
That sounds about right. I think it's like about an 800-pager, 900-pager, something like that. I feel like there's like 100 pages of, notes and stuff at the end, too. So in terms of the actual story,
it's like Unabridged Dune.
Sort of, yeah. But I enjoyed both. I enjoyed reading the book, and I enjoyed watching the series. And if you have Netflix, it's there. And like I said, I think the ebook is probably still, because the book's been out for 10 years, it's probably still a $2 or $3 ebook.
Well, and to be fair, Fred has bought that ebook on 12 different platforms.
Yeah. At least.
So do that little experiment, or just watch the TV show, or just read the book. But if you could do both. I think the TV show was more enjoyable for me because I just read the book and I dug it. So
well, that's like 6 episodes.
It's 7. Yeah, it's 7. Short. Yeah. Well, it's 7
but
episodes,
really long.
But they're an hour long. They are a full hour long. So it's, ends up being more like 10 or so episodes of a typical length show. So that is my pick.
Speaking of long books by British authors who take a long time to read or go through it as audiobooks, how's Jerusalem going there, Jeff?
I did finish Jerusalem, and it's funny because as soon as I finished it, I saw that the audiobook was up, and there's one chapter I am curious about hearing on the audiobook, which is a chapter that's all written in the style of Finnegan's Wake, which was very tough to get through because Alan Moore, of course, tries to be authentic in all things. I was actually going to mention Jerusalem as one of the picks because there's two different versions of it out right now. But instead, I'm going to recommend the new, very short but very enjoyable novel by Warren Ellis called Normal. This is, as with a lot of his stuff, it starts off being something that is distinctly not science fiction, but rapidly becomes something that could be construed as science fiction very rapidly. And it's a story about a place called Normal Head, which is a facility in the Pacific Northwest, which is sort of a quiet and removed, almost a sanitarium, rehabilitation center for burnt out futurists. All of these people who have done predictive models of urban environments and monetary systems and stuff like that. And literally, as they do this, they gaze into the abyss. And sometimes it gets too much for them. And the mega corporations that are paying for their research place them into this facility. And it's the story of a guy who goes into this facility, and while he's there, a locked room mystery takes place next to him, and he has to go around and meet the various burnt out futurists who are there in an attempt to solve what's going on. Warren Ellis did a very brief tour in the U.S. for this, and I got to go see him here in Decatur, just actually about 10 miles from me. And he did some readings, and he gave a talk, and he signed a lot of books, and he answered a lot of questions, and it was very enjoyable to actually see him in the flesh, considering how rare his appearances in the U.S. are. I actually said to him, Fred, something. I said, hi, I do the Three Horsemen podcast, and when we were on SF Signal, we did an episode about your science fiction work, and he said something, words to the effect of, yeah, the science fiction establishment basically ignores me. And I was like, well, we certainly don't. So
I have to throw out there that was very, very interesting, but I got completely distracted by the fact that Fred has a static picture and Jeff has a static picture and John and I both have video going. Jeff's picture over his left shoulder, I believe, is the same map in a gold frame that I have on my wall somewhere.
Oh, that's my wife. She collects antique maps, especially if they're foil maps.
Yeah, I think I had that exact same one.
We have lots and lots of them.
Anyway.
So right, that's my second pick.
Fred.
Cool. Fred. Yes.
Go ahead, Patrick. Fred, go ahead.
Who's running this podcast, Patrick?
You are. Go ahead.
I was getting to that. I was going to have some commentary for Jeff first.
Okay, go ahead.
Now that
go ahead. Warren Ellis, go ahead.
Thrown me off the rails. Jeff, would you say that, I mean, is this similar to Injection, which is, of course, a graphic novel sort of consult?
Did you like Injection?
I did, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I really like
Injection. Trees, I'm looking forward to more of each. If it ever,
I like what do you call it too? Shipwreck. The other,
I haven't read that one yet. I've got it. Yeah, I just got that one, but I haven't.
Yeah,
read.
it's a little tough to follow, but yeah, I love Injection. I think that's great. It does play with some similar themes. He actually did mention that during the talk. He said, but he's being a bit more explicitly diving into the fantastic with Injection. Mm-hmm. He said I reviewed
Injection, I think, for Kirkus.
He said the one thing that they do have in common, and that we're going to see more of in upcoming issues of Injection, is the whole idea of place-specific information, which is something that plays a big role in Normal,
right?
And which he's done a little bit with. Or he said originally the character, the Irish character in there, originally was a British character, and it was all supposed to be a very England-specific
magic or whatever it is that is actually rising to the surface and through the course of the story. And then he sort of put that aside when he introduced the Irish character. But he says there are going to be some issues that take place in Ireland in the future. So,
mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right, my next pick, I mean, is related to Star Trek. Now, who doesn't love Star Trek?
Star Wars fans.
of course. But this is...
Anybody who's seen Forbidden Planet.
Doesn't explain me then, Patrick. This would be the Star Trek Encyclopedia by Michael and Denise Okoda. Mm-hmm. And it's revised and expanded from a couple of works that he mostly has worked on in the past.
I'm friends with him on Facebook, by the way.
Who isn't?
He actually has interacted with me and done stuff. It's cool.
But this is a heavily revised from previous stuff. Like he did, he worked on the Star Trek, the Next Generation Technical Manual.
I have that.
Yep. The Deep Space Nine Technical Manual.
I have that.
What else do you have? Do you have
Keep
this?
Going.
Do you have this?
No, I don't have the encyclopedia.
You're going to love it. Two volumes, massive. I mean, like Jerusalem, this is something that I'd rather have in some ways, both as a physical book and an ebook. Because this thing is just so freaking large. I can just see myself reading it at night in bed and being crushed underneath its weighty mass. You know, you just flip open. I mean, it's the kind of book that I like to read because I wouldn't read it from front to back. I would just flip through it randomly and read essays on the Bajorans or various named ships or various named characters. They've got artwork, original artwork, and they've got series artwork. They've got
Doesn't
pictures.
Have anything about the Grand Nagus.
Oh, probably. Should I look it up? You want me to look it up? Keep talking.
Inconceivable.
Keep talking. I'll look it up. Let's see.
I just like that character. I like the actor, too.
G. Galileo. Gamelon.
I'm sure it's not under N for Nagus.
Maybe. We'll see.
Nagus. Under Gil, or Ferengi.
They got Gilman.
Does it list all of the rules of acquisition? That would be interesting because I don't think I've ever seen like a full list of the rules of acquisition.
I think there was a standalone book of that at one point.
Yes. I have no idea, but I will tell you this. John has completely given up on this podcast at this point.
They do have the Grand Canyon, not the Grand Nagus.
The Grand Nagus, yeah. I just like that character. I liked his voice, and he's on Quark! Quark!
My son is playing the piano in the other room, so I'm just muting my microphone so we don't have to serenade everybody. I'm highly engaged here. I want to keep my microphone muted.
Is it hardcover or softcover?
It's hardcover, and they have Nagus, the. How's that? Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Hardcover, two volumes, slipcase.
Does it explain smooth-headed Klingons versus bumpy-headed Klingons?
You want me to look it up, or should we just keep on going?
Oh, I was just curious if you knew offhand.
I've only like flipped and like randomly, sort of like you would do with.
You know, it's something they don't talk
links.
About. Hmm? It's something they don't talk about.
Unless you're John Ford.
Hmm.
Now, have I out-nerded Patrick? That's the question.
No.
Wow.
Jeff has missed this as well. Jeff has missed the interplay, I can tell. And I've missed Jeff's cackle.
Yes, I have.
I've missed Jeff's cackle. My gosh. It's been a while. That's awesome, Fred.
Yes.
Seriously.
Highly recommended.
Is that like, what's his name? Who did the Marvel Encyclopedia, John? One of our friends.
Forbeck.
Oh, Forbeck. Yeah. Forbeck.
At Forbeck.
And they like sold out.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had to do a second run.
They're not as tall, but they're definitely... The two volumes, I think you have more text than his work.
Mm.
It's pretty amazing stuff. So,
are we going to do a third pick?
If John and Elio is not burned out totally,
I think one more round would be good. Let's do it.
Okay. So Patrick.
Well, since Fred doesn't want me talking about this Trudeau bagel slicing guide with adjustable thickness for $15 and Amazon Prime shipping.
If it's got Amazon Prime, then please mention it.
I'll throw it out there, and we're going to blame Paul for this because Paul used to talk about these books all the time, and Fred and I were just talking about this before we started recording. I have finally gone through almost all, we'll even go that far, of the Vorkosigan Saga books from Bujold, and loved them. Absolutely loved them. And I went through the audiobooks, so it's they're read by Gardner Grover, I think is his name. And I've done all of them except Free Falling. What was it?
Ethan of Athos.
Ethan of Athos. And then the, whatever the last book is called. I think it's essentially the last book.
Well, the most recent, not.
The most recent
is
probably what it is.
And have you read On Basilisk Station yet?
I have not read On Basilisk Station yet. Read. You know I can't pronounce things. That's why I make John do it. The last one is called Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen, the Miles Vorkosigan Adventures Book 17. That's the one I have not read yet. I've gone all the way through Cryoburn.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyed them immensely. I realized just last night that one of the themes I think that I got out of it, that one of the themes that I think are run throughout the books is mental health. Because there's a lot of characters who have mental health issues.
Oh, definitely.
Including...
Or PTSD issues, yeah, or...
PTSD, split personality, yeah, schizophrenia.
Yep, yep.
Dealing
with physical health, affecting your mental health, lots of...
But starting with Bothari and going all the way through Lord Mark,
yep,
you know, a lot of these characters have issues. I will say that... A Civil Campaign, Winterfair Gifts, and Captain Verpatril's Alliance are three of the funniest goddamn books I think I've read in a long time.
Yes.
They had me cracking up a lot. From the Butterbugs to the stuff that you know, Ivan is like, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. They just cracked me up. So I really appreciated those books, though. They were very, very well done. And Paul used to talk about them all the time on SF Signal.
Mm-hmm.
I finally took the plunge and started listening to them. I did tell Fred before I actually listened a little bit out of, order, cause I started with the Warrior's Apprentice and I went through all the Miles books first. And then I started over and read Shards of Honor and Barry R. Were the last two that I just read or listened to. So that's kind of the order I did them in. I appreciated them immensely. I thought they were fantastic. Now I have Babylon's Ashes waiting in my Audible account to listen to. So that's the next thing I'll go back through. And then once I listen to that, I'll be like, God damn it, I want another book.
All right, then you can start the Dave Webbers.
For me, because you for my next pick, because you may be hearing my son's piano improvisational flights of fancy.
No scales, no.
No, well, not yet with that, but he's doing a lot of improvising these days, which we want to encourage him because it's kind of nice that he's sort of interested in doing it. So you're going to be hearing a lot of plunking while I'm talking. So I'm going to do a pick that was sort of inspired by him. My son is on the autism spectrum with people on the Functional Nerds podcast know, because I do mention it. But one of the things in terms of like a reward for him is that we let him watch YouTube videos, and which I've noticed from just talking to other people that that's what a lot of kids do. They watch a lot of YouTube videos. Problem with YouTube is that the whole world's on there.
Oh, yes.
And it's never ending. And if you are kind of a compulsive individual like my son is, where, you know, it's hard to stop because there's always another video that you can keep on watching. And there's sometimes inappropriate videos, even though YouTube does a fairly good job of taking things down. There's lots of stuff with swearing on it. And he was learning, not that I'm an angel and I don't swear, and I'm sure he learned a lot of swearing from hearing me swearing. he was learning a lot from YouTube too. So it was quite a dilemma for us, and the way that we figured out how to deal with it, because it is such a powerful reward for him that we get him to do a lot of work, schoolwork, and other kinds of things with the promise of him being able to have a few minutes to watch his videos, is that what we do now is we signed up for YouTube Red. So that's my recommendation, is YouTube Red. But there's a lot of benefits to this. But the reason why we signed up for it is, if you sign up for YouTube Red, then on your device, now it doesn't work on computers and laptops, but on your device, whether it's an iPad or an iPhone or an Android device or whatever, you can have offline videos. So what we do is we pre-approve whatever videos he's going to watch, and we download them to the device, and then we turn off the internet. Mm-hmm. So he can only watch the 10 or so videos that he has on at any given time. So that way he's not watching anything that we don't want him to watch, and there is a finite amount. There is no next video. So it's a very good solution for us. So if you have a child that watches a lot of videos and you want to control it a little more, that is the best way that we found to do it.
I do see a problem in your plan, though.
Well, if you have a kid that's savvy enough to go and turn the internet back on.
No, not even that. I mean, you say there's a finite amount, but if you have 10 videos, they can watch them 10 times, 20 times, 30 times.
Well, that's true, too. And there is a little bit of that as well. So you can work, but it's that discovering the next thing and the next thing that was more of a problem for him. Yep. But what's cool is the way that Google is sort of presenting YouTube Red is quite similar to the way that Amazon does Prime. Meaning for that $10 a month, which we were like, $10 a month. It's like, you know what though, whatever, it's worth it because, you know, it'll help get this in line. But you get, like, Amazon Prime basically throws in a million things for that $10 a month or whatever it is, like $99 a year. I'm not sure what Amazon Prime is. It's something like that. But you get like the shipping and you get the videos and
you get a free ebook every month too.
Do you?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they give you editor's choice 6 books.
Oh yes,
and you can pick one of those.
Yes, yeah, there's that too. So Prime throws in a lot of stuff, and that's kind of what Google is doing with YouTube Red now. So in addition to being able to download, they take all the commercials off of YouTube, all the ads. So if you pay that $10 a month, you never have to see an ad. And I have like YouTube up on my TV and my Roku player. And that's pretty nice when I want to, like, you know, jump down the well of watching a bunch of 80s heavy metal videos. Now I don't have to sit through any ads. So that's pretty nice. But what I've really been playing with it is Google Play Music, which is the Google's version of streaming music, which I have to say has pretty much the same catalog as Spotify and Apple Music. And I, as much as I've been a fan of Apple Music because of the smart playlists and stuff, I've really been spending a lot of time in Google Play Music, and the interface is a hell of a lot better than iTunes. And I'm trying to find a way around the playlist thing, because I still love those smart playlists in iTunes. And I just kind of feel like, come on, Google, you can't put an engineer on this for a week and get them to be able to do the smart playlist. How hard can it be? But it's great. It's so if you want to look for an alternative to Spotify or Apple Music, it's pretty compelling. And you get all the other stuff, too. So check it out. It's, you know, I think you might even get the first month free kind of a deal, possibly. But try it. I think it's a good gift to give, is give someone a month's worth of YouTube Red. So that's my pick.
Okay. I guess it's back over to me. Should I go graphics or should I go literary?
Ooh. I'll say literary.
I don't think you've done literary yet.
Yeah, do literary.
You did graphics.
Yeah. Well, I have one of each. So this is a literary or nonfiction, philosophy maybe even. There's a author, Lauren Isley, who often wrote about nature. I think my first encounter with him was in a rather strange...
I've always been a fan of nurture.
There are some things I don't miss about the SF Single podcast.
Yeah, just think of that.
getting constantly thrown off the rails is one of those things I don't miss.
That's why we work, Fred, because I can stay on the rails. I've had a lot of reps staying on the rails. I find ignoring works best.
Yeah, you'll have to teach me the trick sometime. Yeah. Anyway, Lauren Isley, my first encounter with him was in a rather strange anthology called Survival Printout, which came out in the deep, dark, early days of the 70s when we all thought we were going to die from pollution or nuclear war or... you know, things like that. Thank God we've gone all past all that kind of threat now. But he wrote an essay in there called The Star Thrower, which was basically a description of walking along the beach and encountering someone who was throwing starfish back into the ocean to save them. And, you know, think of that as a metaphor for you know, little random acts of kindness that you do from day to day to try and help one person at a time. So the Library of America, which has come out with big, fat, very nice volumes on people like Lovecraft and Vonnegut and Philip K. Dick, and now most recently Ursula K. Le Guin, if you want to talk about genre people, they've done two volumes of his works. It's collectively called Collected Essays on Evolution, Nature, and the Cosmos. And they contain things like The Immense Journey, The Firmament of Time, The Unexpected Universe, Parts of the Star Thrower, The Invisible Pyramid, and The Night Country. And, you know, none of these books are really like solid A to Z books, you know, page one through its, you know, essays and things. So you can flip around. It's the kind of thing that I like to try and read at night. So at the end of the day, when I've had a really bad day at work, I can at least think that I've, you know, kind of educated myself just a tiny little bit. So that's my recommendation, Lauren Isley.
Cool. You know, you skipped Jeff.
No. I figured we'd finish with Jeff.
Oh, Jeff, you get to finish it off.
Yep. And then we'll finish it off with John Stevens tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jeff.
Well, I know that Patrick is the type of guy who likes to watch movie adaptations and then tell everybody that the original comics were better.
It depends.
And I know that there's an entire stripe of fans out there with that particular hang up. I tend to be one among them. Anyways, I would highly recommend that people prep themselves for next year by reading the Valerian and Laureline comics.
I actually just grabbed some of those, Jeff.
They are on iTunes, including most of them are in English on iTunes,
yeah,
actually.
Amazon as well.
By Jean-Claude Mézières and Pierre Christian. Mm-hmm. And I know there was a volume that just came out. I think volume 16 came out this year. But I highly recommend them. I remember there was a big post that somebody did. I think it was Popular Mechanics or something like that, about how many things Star Wars actually lifted from these comics.
Yep.
But they are pretty sweeping space opera pulp. They are very European, which means not everything makes sense. But they are definitely worth. They're very good eye candy. They run the range from space opera, planetary romance,
and a very unique style.
Yeah, very, very much so.
And have you seen that trailer? Did you
like
that trailer?
Yes, I have seen the trailer, and I'm very much looking forward to it. Somebody pointed out, and I forget who. Actually, I think it might have been John Byrne, to go back to him. Somebody pointed out that much like Fifth Element, this is a movie that spares no expense on the CGI, but still makes the aliens look like humans in masks.
Yeah. Because this is another Luc Besson movie.
Yeah. So I'm very much looking forward to that. But I've been rereading some of the early e-files that I have of the comics, but I have not read the latest one that came out in June. But yes, I would highly recommend getting yourself educated on that so you can watch the movie and see whether or not they adapted it well. I am looking forward to it,
though. I am too. Yeah, that looks like an awesome movie, and I just picked up a couple of those books as well for my Kirkus column.
Mm.
So I was planning on doing that here soon.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I'm curious how many listeners from SF Signal followed you guys over to the Three Horsemen. I hope like lots of them. But in case there are people who have come fresh to the Three Horsemen who never listened to SF Signal, I feel the need to explain the bagel thing.
Well, before you do that, let me just say that, you know, I appreciate you two guys coming on, because one of the things we've said a couple of times is how much we miss the community that we had at SF Signal, and you know, I appreciate the hard work that you did, that DiNardo did, JP did, and everyone else did that ran that shop, because I mean, you know, that was pretty unique, a unique group of people. I made a lot of friends that way, including.
Do not make me cry.
Well, I'm sorry, but maybe I will. But you know, we would not be doing the Three Horsemen if it wasn't for SF Signal. And
that's true.
John and Neely and I would not have sat in a car in the rain unless it was for SF Signal. So
John and Elia would not have quit the SF Signal podcast immediately if it were not for SF Signal. He was like, wait a minute, this is taking too long. Screw this noise.
So there you go. So explain the bagels.
Well, when we used to record the SF Signal podcast, DiNardo, our bagel overlord, would listen in. He would sit there on mute and would not participate in the bulk of the episodes. But we kind of had an unwritten rule where we were all trying to get him to come off of mute. And he is a transplant. He grew up in New York. You know, bagels were a staple of his diet. And now he lives in Texas, where you just can't get the same quality of bagel there that you can in New York. So, you know, it's one of those things where when he and his family travel to New York City, they immediately, like, they get off the plane and they run to a deli and get a bagel. And it's very specific places, you know, that they go and get them. So it's a very big deal with them. And so one of the things that we used to do is we would try to get John to come off of mute by mentioning bagel stuff. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And when we did these year-end roundups, I would scour Amazon in different places to find some of the most ridiculous bagel-related products ever and put them in the list to try to get him to come off mute. And
you know what I can't get down here in Georgia? I can't get pierogies.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
I can't find pierogies anywhere.
Well, and I've told you before, here in Colorado, I went to get a cannoli, and they stuffed it with sausage and put marinara sauce on it.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, what the hell? And oh. I still remember when I went one of the first Mexican restaurants I went to in Colorado, they had chimichangas. And or no, not chimichangas. They had chili relleno. And they said, we don't fry ours. And I'm like, then it's not a chili relleno.
Yeah.
If really. It's not fried. And they're like, well, some people don't like them fried. Then it's just a stuffed pepper.
Yeah.
And then they also do the chimichanga. They're like, we have chimichangas that aren't fried. Then it's a burrito.
Right. There's already names for these things.
Yes.
You're not doing anything new.
No. No, you're not. And I vaguely remember the episode that you keep talking about, Fred, where you guys were in the car. And I think, John, weren't you like frozen because it was like super cold?
No, humid, hot. Oh, my God.
Well, there was a whole slate of episodes that we did very early in the Functional Nerds where, unfortunately, John did not have a recording space and kept doing them in his garage.
Yeah, that's why I didn't do the SF Signal podcast, because I would be sitting on the round tables that where I would, you know, only have my, you know, a couple minutes to do my pick or whatever. And then I would just be standing in my garage in the middle of winter. And I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore. Screw this. Like, I, so, yeah. So no Hugo Awards for me. So but that's it.
Yeah, they put that on my book cover. You know, 2-time Hugo Award winner.
Yep. I was like, I
it not for fiction.
You don't have to tell anybody.
I know, but still, it's kind of fun.
Well, Jeff and Fred, thank you for having us on the show today. It's great to reconnect with you fellas. And I hope people enjoy this on both ends, on your podcast and for the Functional Nerds listeners, because we are going to run this in the feed as well. So we hope you enjoyed this Power Pack X-Men-like crossover.
You said both ends, not that. Yeah, we got them coming.
And with that...
And stay tuned, because John Stevens will be next.
Yeah, and we hold on. We have a Patreon. Why don't you guys have a Patreon yet? You should have a Patreon. Help pay for these things.
We're on a professional podcasting network, Patrick.
Oh, right. You guys went on that thing.
We sold out.
At Worldcon, I went up to a table, and it was one of those networks, and they had all these cards spread out on their table of all their podcasts. And I walked up and I'm like, oh, wow, you have a lot of podcasts. They're like, yeah, we do. I said, one of the ones I listen to all the time is the Functional Nerds. Do you have them? The guy's like, no. And he goes over and he gets on his computer and he's like doing stuff. He's like, no, we don't have them. Oh, they have a WordPress site. You should never have a WordPress site. That's terrible. And I'm just sitting there, and I had the Beyond the Trope folks with me. And if you guys don't know Beyond the Trope yet, you should check them out. They're a great podcast too. And when we walked away, they looked at me and they go, you're mean.
They know you well.
So you were at a WorldCon and you weren't in the lobby.
Yeah, that was the other thing. Gail Carriger actually came up to me and she says, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah." She goes, "You're in the bar." And I said, "I know." She goes, "You're mixing and mingling with people." I said, "I know. No one will recognize me this way."
Wow.
WorldCon, right. John, WorldCon is a convention. It's a science. People travel to it and attend it, and they go to panels and they meet and greet people in the bar. It's this whole thing. You should try it sometime.
I know. It's going to happen someday.
Just so you understand, it's different from the only convention that Fred goes to, which is HonorCon.
Right. Yeah. I know.
Haven't been to two of them in a while. So.
Yeah.
Well, maybe someday. Well, anyway, Functional Nerds people, thank you for joining us this week. And Three Horsemen people, thank you for listening to Patrick and I ruin their show.
Thank you, everyone. And now we're going to continue our session, having said goodbye to John and Elio and Patrick Hester. And we're now going to welcome Mr. John Stevens. How are you, Mr. John Stevens?
The mystery guest is here. Wait a minute.
Well, we actually had a bit of a debate who the equivalent of you on the Functional Nerds was. And I think the conclusion was there was
no. It wasn't Patrick.
It wasn't Patrick.
Tell me it wasn't Patrick. Okay.
It was kind of John and Elio, but not quite. So there you go.
Right. There you go. Mm. I am unique. No one can replace me.
This is true.
Except a highly stylized robot, probably. But, you know. We won't talk about that now.
Would that be Google Now Plus or Siri minus or what?
Something like that.
And that's appropriate, seeing that we're now on the Incomparable Network, which has a show called Robot or Not. So maybe you can guest star on it sometime.
Am I a robot? Can you figure it out?
Yep. We'll have to do the Turing test. So to continue with our picks, I guess we'll start with you, John, since both Jeff and I have a few more, but you're fresh and new and ready to empty people's wallets.
I am fresh and new and exciting. My pick, I didn't have a lot, actually, because I am terrible at picking out gifts.
Oh, what would you buy yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
of course, that's what you end up doing is like, what would I buy for myself?
There you go. That works. You are the target audience of this podcast.
First, I am our demographic. So I picked several things. I picked, first of all, a book, which was Ursula Le Guin's collected novellas, The Found and the Lost, which Saga Press just put out in October, and has 13 novellas and is, you know, several hundred pages long, and quite a little imposing, but it has a lot. I mean, it just has stuff that I had never heard of, actually. There are like three or four of the novellas in there that I had never heard of. Yeah, I think I've only read about half of what's in the book. So it's a really nice collection to have.
Nope.
You know, both if you're a Le Guin fan and if you're just sort of, you know, a science fiction fantasy fan, having this stuff all in one place is really quite lovely.
Nope.
And, knowing the quality of the novellas that I have read, I am quite certain that, you know, the rest will be on a similar level. So, and it's, you know, it's a nice thing to have on your shelf, and it's a nice thing to read and read again. And I mean, this is sort of the stuff you want to sort of keep around. So I think it's a very good gift idea for all those reasons.
And did you pick up by any chance the Library of America edition?
Oh yeah, I have. Oh, there's There's plenty of Le Guin you can buy for the holidays.
Yes, I was just wondering how much of that overlaps, if anything.
I have to go look at the table of contents for the Library of America again, mm-hmm. but I don't think anything overlaps. Okay.
And then I think there were, what, two
because
collections?
It's very specifically, yeah. I mean, the Library of America is very specifically her early work that is non-fantasy.
Right.
It's sort of alternate timeline sort of stuff, but she, her early work has a really strong realist mooring to it. It's a little sparse and very controlled. And there's certainly a small sense of oddness about her early work, but it's not really fantasy. And that's what she wanted to collect, or that's what they wanted, I think, they wanted to collect first.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not science fiction stuff, because they're snobs at the Library of America.
Philip K. Dick, Kurt Vonnegut, and H.P. Lovecraft, not too much snobby.
No, not very much in that respect. And then they've done a couple volumes of just sort of random science fiction classics, too.
Well, yeah, the Gary K. Wolf box
set. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's you. Exactly.
And then I think
there's also available for her Words Are My Matter, which is a nonfiction collection.
Right.
I think so. I have a copy of that too, and it's sort of on the stack. Small Beer, yep. So Small Beer put that out.
And I think they did another one this year.
It was Complete Arsenia.
No, that's the Library of America.
That is Library of America, yeah.
I thought
they did the selected short stories. I think they did a short story collection.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Saga Press also put out the Unreal and the Real,
right,
which is a short story selection. And then I don't know if Small Bear put anything else out by her. But there's a lot of stuff coming out in the last couple of years, certainly. Oh, that two volume set from, was it a year or two ago? Of her short stories. That was Small Beer, I believe.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a good time to be a fan of Ursula K. Le Guin.
It's. Well, and she had a collection of her latest poetry put out by PM Press.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like I said, there's been quite a lot of Le Guin coming out. Since she won the National Book Award Lifetime Achievement, people have been ramping up getting her stuff out there, so, which is nice. I'm glad that a lot of more of her stuff is getting out there. So,
cool.
So you know, any of those would be a fine gift for a literature lover or a science fiction lover or people who like to read. So that was my first thought. And then I was trying to think about movies to recommend. Fortunately, the Criterion Collection has put out two movies that I think are, they may not be strictly science fiction, but they're sort of surreal, magically real, and I say they count, so I'm going to talk about them. And so the two movies that they've been released just in the last couple of months are Louis Buñuel's The Exterminating Angel and Akira Kurosawa's Dreams. They, like I said, they're not strictly science fiction fantasy, but they're very strange and they're very surreal, and they're two pretty fantastic movies that I think would interest people who like science fiction and fantasy. The Buñuel is a story about a group of high society folk who go to a dinner and end up trapped in the music room for reasons they can't understand. And their descent into chaos and mayhem and all the hilarity that follows that. So it's surreal, but it's not, I think, as surreal as some of his other stuff that he's better known for. And I like the characters, which aren't hugely developed, but are very well done. And it's just a film to sort of watch with a mixture of mirth and despair, I guess, is the best way to put it. But it's such a great classic movie, and in the Criterion Collection, it's going to be really nicely produced. So that, and Akira Kurosawa's Dreams is literally a movie that he made about his dreams. So it's a series of small vignettes. I think there's 8 of them that basically riff off of his own visions and dreams from a childhood until you know, late in his life. This is one of Kurosawa's last movies, was Dreams. And the thing about this is, while it shares a certain amount of surrealism with Buñuel, it couldn't be much more different in tone or in presentation. So, you know, Buñuel is shooting in black and white, and they're often fairly tight shots, and they're very crisp, and there's a sort of attempt to create a certain amount of visual realism that contrasts with what happens with the action. And with Kurosawa, like, Dreams is lush and on a huge palette and super saturated colors. And again, things happening you may not understand, but that are beautiful to watch. And what he's going for is much more of a sort of life-affirming tone, sort of talking about, you know, life can be terrible and wonderful, but it's, you know, life is vibrant, and, you know, life is not just a spiral down into despair and oblivion. So they actually make a nice contrast. So I would get both for someone, just for the contrast. Mm-hmm. Or, like I said, for the visual power, and also because they're so odd. They both have extras. Okay. I don't think there's a lot. Yeah, there's not a lot on the Buñuel. There is an interview with the screenwriter. There's an interview with a couple of the actors, because, you know, it's from a much earlier time when they didn't make 10 mini documentaries to go with it or anything. Yeah. And of course, in contrast, the Dreams comes with much more on the disc extras. There's commentary. There is a making of documentary that I think is about as long as the actual movie, if not longer, because, you know, that's what you do, so right?
It's like the Blade Runner box set. Yeah. 4 versions of the film.
And there's interviews. There's actually a documentary about Kurosawa himself.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, it's got a lot more stuff packed into it than the Buñuel does. And they do have a short trailer on the Criterion site. And you can see what I'm talking about in terms of the visuals that are bold and they're odd and they're quite open to interpretation as to what they mean. And that's, I think, another thing that binds these two movies together is they're not trying to tell you something specific. They're telling you something very general. And Buñuel specifically said in interviews that he wanted people to have to interpret the movie for themselves, even though it's often been called an allegory for class and for politics. So that element, I think, that wideness of interpretation makes them very interesting viewing for people who like science fiction fantasy, because you can see a lot in both of these movies. You can see a lot in them, and you can see points of contention as well as some, not didactically, but at a certain level, sort of a lesson about life. They're very different lessons in the end.
Between those two and the Del Toro box set, I might be spending a lot of money on DVDs this year.
Criterion is coming for you.
Yeah, if they ever invite me to visit their closet, I'm definitely going to go do that.
Yeah.
But first, I guess I have to become a film director. So anything else on your wish list?
Yeah, and then from the comics world, Daniel Clowes' latest book, Patience, from Fantagraphics, which is a science fictional story of obsessive love. And from what I've seen of the art is extremely trippy.
Like Jack Kirby trippy, or?
No, just, I mean, very colorful, somewhat nonlinear, surreal in that sense. Not Kirby in terms of being, you know, smashing you literally in the face with a fist made of stardust or something. But it's again, it sounds very promising. I like Clowes' work even when he fails, because I find that he's really trying to do different things with the graphic medium, and I appreciate him trying to do that. But Patience sounds like it could be quite good. So I would definitely put that on my wish list as well.
Neat.
So that's the recommendations that I have.
Okay. Do you have any more to add, Jeff?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this was a fairly good year for anthologies and collections. And aside from, you know, the Vandermeer's big book of science fiction, there was a couple I really liked. Karen Lord's New World's Old Ways, Speculative Tales of the Caribbean, Ken Liu's Invisible Planets, the translated contemporary Chinese SF. But the one that really stuck out for me was Jess Nevins did a collection called Homefront Horrors, Frights Away from the Frontlines, 1914 to 1918. And this is basically a overview of some of the horror and weird fiction that was being generated during World War One. And it's got, you know, Algernon Blackwood, and it's got a W.W. Jacobs story in it, and it's got a Lord Dunsany story in it, but it's got a few others by authors who I had never heard of before. Mason Clare, and who was the other one that I really liked? Oh, The King Waits by Clemens Dane is really good. Fairly interesting, and he's in his introduction he talks about where fiction was going during World War One, and it was a fairly intriguing collection. It was below my radar until I actually saw it available, and then I picked it up. And there's an M.R. James story in there called An Episode of Cathedral History that was pretty good. But it's got Saki, and it's got Sir Hugh Clifford and a few other authors. And it was fairly interesting, nice little time capsule of stuff that came out around that time. All fitting fairly seamlessly into what we consider, you know, classic horror, like we talked about a couple months ago. But good stuff, really good stuff. But, you know, strictly speaking about gifts, I mean, if someone you know is a fan and they don't have the Vandermeer collection, big book of science fiction, that's definitely a sizable gift to give somebody. But there were a lot of really good anthologies this year, so any of them would work.
Yep. That's it for you?
Yep, so that's...
I've got one more specific recommendation that I didn't get to with the session with Jeff. With Patrick and John Anilio, and two general recommendations. So my specific recommendation is, finally, I'm getting to the graphic suggestion, and that is 2016 finally saw the return of Mobius in paper. So this is the first volume of the Mobius Library from Dark Horse. The World of Edina, which I guess it's a couple of stories. I mean, it evolved out of a car, something he did for a car manufacturer of all things, and then eventually grew into this vast galaxy-spanning epic, mostly concentrating on two characters. As with some of his collaborations, it's visually great. The story kind of makes little sense in parts, but, you know, a lot of great artwork, and it's so great to see his stuff back in print. In the back of the book, they talk about the next couple of installments. 2017, we're going to see the art of Edina, and then 2018, we have to wait, unfortunately, for the next three parts, three volumes called Inside Mobius, Parts 1, 2, and 3. So, hopefully this one does well enough to fund the next four. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then my two general recommendations, kind of related to the mention of small beer, I'd recommend, I don't know if they do gift cards or if you just want to give someone a Visa card and point them to the site or whatever, but Waitlist Books is a really great alternative to places like Amazon or Barnes & Noble's. They have a ton of subscriptions to now added, they've added recently fantasy and science fiction, but they've got Inner Zone, they've got Clark's World, they've got Lightspeed, they've got all those, you know, independent e-zines, and they've got lots of books, including a lot of the Le Guin titles that we mentioned, and a ton more. I mean, if you want to look for some little tiny sliver of genre, they probably have at least one book on it there if you dig hard enough. The site's a little clunky as far as design, but man, I always end up spending a lot of money there. And then my final recommendation is just look to the small presses, and I'll include a link to one that I end up spending a lot of money at, which is Subterranean, which just got some more money from me for the second volume of the Expanse series out in hardcover with beautiful artwork and signed by the two authors. So, you know, they always get me at least a couple times a year with something from Ten Powers or these guys, or, I mean, I've bought books by Robert Block, I've bought books by Harlan Ellison, James Blaylock, Philip K. Dick. I mean, they've got a really amazing catalog. The only problem is, of course, most of the books are small runs, so you gotta get on the mailing list, or you gotta respond right away, or you'll miss out. So that's my two final gift suggestions to help you guys out there empty your wallets. So let's talk about culture, or lack thereof, consumed. So who would like to speak first on this subject?
I'll go first. That would be me. All right, so I'm going to start actually with filmed material. So I watched a couple of Netflix offerings, science fiction-y ones, this past few weeks. And I thought I talked about this before, but I went over the last episode, and I guess I didn't talk about it, the Brazilian science fiction show 3%. And so on a complete lark, I decided to watch it. I saw it come up on my Netflix feed, and I'd never heard of it, so I was very intrigued. And it is actually a Brazilian TV show that is basically a dystopian series set in a future where the planet is apparently severely wiped out. And these people living in Brazil have been reduced to living in basically a city in the middle of what is now the Amazon desert. But there exists an option for them to escape to a place called the offshore, which is apparently a utopia where everything is awesome. And there's no, you know, need or want or any stuff like that. Only 3% can actually make it to the offshore. And the way that they do that, of course, is by having a contest called The Process. Mm-hmm. So what the show is about on the surface is a new group of recruits from this ravaged city trying to get into the utopia. But what it sort of becomes over the course of the episodes is more of a, again, sort of an allegory about ideas about who's worthy and who's unworthy in society and how we should form it. And as the six main characters go through the process, we find out a lot more about the utopia itself. We find out a lot more about the people and their ideas about the utopia. And we watch them go through the process, which is supposedly very scientific and rigorous and blah, 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 but turns out to basically be the insanity of a martinet. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about the show is you see a lot of the sort of human weakness behind utopia and the process. And the characters are fairly well done. I think the situations are kind of ridiculous. Like the tests for the process are kind of ridiculous. But I think that's part of the point of the show, is to say that the way that they choose people for their paradise is really not scientific and rigorous. It's very much conditioned by pre-expectation and by prejudice, basically. So while some of it made me wince because of the deployment of really sort of tired science fiction cliches, a lot of it was actually really interesting to watch because of what I thought they were trying to do with the premise, which was not subvert it, but actually to open it up and sort of reveal all the nooks and crannies and all the problems of these kind of science fiction tropes, and then apply them to discussing the questions about society. So I liked it. I think I'm actually going to watch it again to see what I missed the first time. It is in Portuguese, so you have to read captions. Yeah. But I have actually been doing pretty well with that. When I started watching Narcos, I was kind of worried that there was so much Spanish. But by the second season, it was so natural to just to read the subtitles and follow along that it wasn't a problem. I didn't find it a problem for this either. So explore new stuff.
Yep.
I also... yes. I also watched a movie called Spectral. It's a very recent addition to Netflix. And it is basically a science fiction action movie that tries to use, you know, a particular conceit to create the difficulties that the characters face. But basically it's set in the near future, where the U.S. Army has, for some reason, gone to another country to help them fight an insurgency in Europe, actually. And they encounter what appear to be ghosts of the war coming back and killing them. So they send an engineer to try to figure out what's going on. And there's a supernatural tone for part of the film, but then it gives way to more of a science fictional approach. So it's corny because it is just basically at the basic level, it's just an action movie. They go, they shoot stuff in act one, they go and shoot stuff in act two, they go and shoot stuff in act three. But what I liked about it was that the hero is actually not the soldiers, but the engineer. I'm pretty sure they're trying to provide something concrete in terms of the science. Okay. But it's basically theoretical physics. So I have no idea how real it is. But that made for something interesting too, because part of the movie is just a mystery of how to deal with these things. So it's at once a corny science fiction action movie, but it has a few interesting elements to it. It's another movie where there's actually some character development. They don't make all of the characters just, you know, cardboard cutouts. Mm-hmm. So that was nice too. This is a Netflix movie.
American or...
American.
Okay.
Yeah, it's American. Emily Mortimer's in it. The guy who played Herc in Pacific Rim is in it. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, it's enjoyable. And then the last piece of filmed media I wanted to talk about was Riff Tracks.
Yes.
Yes, a bunch of the Riff Track episodes are now available on Amazon Prime if you have it, which is nice because they're expensive.
Yep.
I went to the Riff Track site after I watched one of the ones on Amazon. I was like, are you kidding me? Fortunately, there's a number of them on Amazon Prime, and I watched two of them. I watched their take on The Sword and the Sorcerer, which is a beloved, terrible movie of mine.
Oh, that's... who was that?
Lee Horsley.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, yes.
Yeah, and they did a pretty funny take on it, too, so that was cool. Mm-hmm. And then Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Classic.
Which they did live, which was one of their live episodes. Yeah, that's another classic that... Sword and the Sorcerer I laugh at. Manos I wince at. Yeah. But you can't... It's sort of you can't stop watching because you're curious what the hell they're going to do next. And their live show with that was really, really well done. They really did a great job riffing that one.
Yeah, I saw the... I haven't seen the Riff Tracks version, but I saw the Mystery Science version of that way back when it was on network TV. So,
right.
God, that's forever burned in my memory.
That was very enjoyable. And they have some other stuff I'm going to try to watch too. They have the movie that Sean Astin made right before he started doing Lord of the Rings. It's called Icebreaker. He's the hero and Bruce Campbell is the villain. So I'm very curious to see what that's all about. But those I like, not because necessarily because they make fun of movies, but I tend to think of it as sort of finding the humor in the movies. I mean, Manos, they were really, you know, making fun of. But a lot of their humor, or I think their better humor, is stuff that they mine out of the film. Misinterpretations, malapropisms, and stuff like that. And it reminded me how much I miss Mystery Science Theater 3000. Yep. That was sort of the biggest takeaway I think I got was that, I mean, you immediately thought, oh, I really miss MST3K. Because that's, you know, one of my favorite things is to be disparaging about movies. Mm-hmm. Everyone's got to have a hobby, right? So if you have Amazon Prime, I definitely recommend checking out those. And also Megaforce.
Oh, God.
I watched the Megaforce one, too.
Which, that was...
Oh, I forgot how awesome that movie was. The guy who plays the villain, whose name I now unfortunately forget, just does a great job. He knows exactly what his job is in the movie. Like, everyone around him is being really earnest, but he understands that his job in the movie is to be, you know, a scenery chewing wackadoodle. And that's what he does, and it's great. Mm-hmm. See what else they've got to offer for that. But so that was my film stuff. And then I finally finished Fossil Capital, which was a very long and very dense, and was good, but not as good as I wanted it to be for the effort I had to make to read it. I think he's got a really good idea, which is that, you know, we cannot extract climate change from the rise of industrialization. And he has a lot of really great historical detail about the early development of industrialization and how it worked. And he has a really, really interesting take on that as well. So it's actually, I think, a book that people who are interested in science fiction could do to read, because in a way he's talking about how capitalism creates technological innovation, like the positive aspects and the negative aspects, and how those are inseparable from social ideas and culture as well. So I think it's rewarding, but I didn't feel completely satisfied with this argument, and as I said, it felt a little too much work for what I got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I finished it, so I was very proud of myself. And I also read, continuing to try to find Warren Ellis stuff I haven't read. I read Anna Mercury, the first and I think only volume of Anna Mercury.
No, there was two.
Oh, there were two. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I read the first one, and I was whelmed.
Well.
I was definitely whelmed.
Yep, that's about my reaction was.
The premise is fascinating, but I didn't need half the book to be a guy explaining the premise to another guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other half being relatively incoherent action sequences that fetishized the female character.
No, she's very good at falling through the air posed just so.
Yes, with their boobs out, mostly.
Well, that's part of the just so, I guess.
Yeah, that's the just so. Je ne sais quoi.
Yes. A lot of je ne sais quoi.
So, I think Facundo Percio's art is really nice. But like I said, half the art is this old white dude telling another old white dude about all the conceits. And, you know, what I wanted was maybe 3 or 4 pages of that and then go do the stuff. So it just felt exposition heavy. And it felt really like it really dragged.
Mm-hmm.
Despite there being snappy action sequences, I really felt that it dragged. I felt that in a number of points, we saw things we didn't need to see, like, you know, like Andy Mercury getting dressed up to go out and fight. And it happens actually more than once. It's like, why do we need to see that? Why don't we just go from I've got to go out and fight to going out and fighting? So, yeah, that was not my favorite Warren Ellis. But I'm glad I'm reading this stuff to get a fuller picture of his body of work.
I guess we're just going to have to do another episode.
Yeah.
Despite his assertions to
part two, the crappy stuff.
Oh, there's been new stuff since the last time. You know,
Tree's
injection, the book, the novel. I mean, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. No, and Trees is great. I mean, you know, he does great stuff. This was not one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last two things I have consumed are actually dissertations.
Of course.
And actually, there's a third one I started reading about masculinity in early science fiction, but I haven't gotten very far with that one yet, so I'll talk about that one next time. But the two I did read this time were first one called The Apocalypse, the post-apocalyptic film genre in American culture, 1968 to 2013, by Emma Ann Harris. And if that sounds like a weird time period to use, it's because it is. And furthermore, within the dissertation, she breaks that time up into three smaller periods with gaps in between them of years. And I'm still not sure, even though I read the dissertation, why that's necessary. Mm-hmm. So what the dissertation is partly a breakdown of all the films with this theme and the elements she's looking for in them. And then she discusses three particular case studies, which seemed like odd choices to me. She chose The Ultimate Warrior from 1975. She chose Steel Dawn from, I think it was 87 that Steel Dawn was made, Patrick Swayze movie. And then she chose Will Smith's I Am Legend from 2007. And those are her case studies. And they seemed like odd case studies for the post-apocalyptic genre because they feel a little outside the general trends, but her argument is that they're not. They're actually good exemplars of the period she's talking about. So there's a lot of good information in it. There's a lot of interesting analysis. Like, the things she pulls out of the movies are very thoughtful. But I didn't really think her overall thesis made sense. And then when I went back through her list of movies, I found gaps of the like movies she didn't include. It's like, she didn't include any of the Mad Max movies.
Yeah, that's true.
In that period, first of all. I mean, then I started thinking of other ones, too. So it's kind of interesting, but I'm not sure I'd recommend it unless you're really interested in post-apocalyptic films. So, like, maybe David Annandale would be interested in it, but a layperson, shall we say. I don't know if it's worth it. But the other one I read was called Bugs After the Bomb, Insect Representations in Post-Atomic American Fiction and Film. Catherine S. That's a mouthful, huh? By Catherine S. Castle, and that was really good. The interesting contrast I found between these two dissertations was the first one seemed a little lean in terms of material, and the second one, The Bugs After the Bomb, was really rich. Her analysis was very rich. She really lays out her ideas in really, really, really copious detail. And she takes stuff from several different vantage points to talk about her subject. So the basic thesis of Bugs After the Bomb is that she believes that, as she says, is what she calls post-atomic American fiction film. So after 1945, for many years, was trying to figure out how to talk about the anxieties of living in the nuclear age and the possibility of self-destruction and how humans got to that point. And her basic thesis is that all these bug movies are picking at those anxieties and about our anxiety about actually about being human and being able to radically change the environment or destroy ourselves. And then she goes from there to talk about all this stuff. So I actually enjoyed that. It was well written. It was very well analyzed and discussed. So for your dissertation reading pleasure, I would recommend it.
Why not?
And that is my culture consumed. That was a mouthful.
Jeff?
Well, I got a couple things I wanted to mention real quick. Number one, I went back and reread all the issues of Monstrous by Marjorie Liu and Sana Takeda. And there had been a bit of a gap between the last few issues, but I went back and reread the whole thing, and wow, it's really good. And it's probably some of the most lush art that's currently being done on comics. I think once in a while it strives to be a bit too cute, but really good stuff. Really good creatures and monsters and lots of fun eye candy. I also want to mention something that came out of Civil War II in Marvel, which still hasn't finished, which is just a wreck. It's just a train wreck of a storyline. But one of the books that it has already spun off is called The Champions by Mark Waid and Humberto Ramos. And the premise is that most of the teenage characters, the Cyclops from the past, Ms. Marvel, Spider-Man, Nova, the younger Nova, and the new Hulk, whose name I always forget, Amadeus Cho, basically get together and say, we got to not be idiots like the adult superheroes running around. And it's been fairly interesting. Mark Waid is one of those writers that I tend to read just about anything he does. It's interesting in the fact that it actually, like Ms. Marvel and the younger Nova, who are two characters that I really don't like the way they're portrayed in their own books at all. I really can't emphasize this enough how much I hate this Nova. Mark Waid actually makes them relatable to an extent. He's very good at doing group dynamics. The group also has Viv, who was the Vision's daughter from the Vision 12-issue miniseries, which I highly recommend, by the way. She's in it as well, and she was incredibly compelling in the Vision series, and she's very good here as well. But I'm gonna keep an eye on this book. It's been enjoyable. They basically decide, you know what, there's some problems in the world. Let's go fix them. It's an interesting little counterpoint to the Ultimates, which has been probably my favorite Marvel book lately. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. The other one that has been fairly intriguing. Oh, the first issue of Dr. Aphra came out, Fred. I meant to tell you that if you hadn't picked it up already. The other book that I wanted to mention that just started is The Unworthy Thor, which is what's actually happened to the Odin son. While Jane Foster's been running around with the hammer, and Jason Aaron's writing this book as well, and the art is by Olivier Coppel, I think is how the last name is pronounced, who I've always been a big fan of. He's done a lot of books that I've really enjoyed. And the second issue, I believe, just came out. Yeah, second issue. And there is some spectacular art, but there's also a lot of playing around with the premise of the hammers and what they can do, which is interesting because there was a great origin of Mjolnir story in Mighty Thor a couple of months ago, which was just fantastic. Jason Aaron is so good dealing with the Thor franchises and all things Asgardian. And the best thing about The Unworthy Thor is that it doesn't have Malekith in it, because Malekith has just been in too many damn books lately, and I don't like him as a villain. He's no way to make that character interesting. And the other thing I want to mention is the fact that I finished Jerusalem by Alan Moore after probably took me about 4 weeks total. I really took my time with it. reading this book, so the book is split into three parts, three books, and reading the first book, The Burrows, it was almost as if I was listening to a best of Alan Moore. A lot of the things that he has riffed on in his various series, a lot of stuff that sort of felt a little like something from Promethea. There was a lot of historical stuff that was going on. And the first third of it, the first book, is basically a series of vignettes about these various characters at different points in history in the town of Northampton and how they all managed to just sort of brush up against one another through time and space. It was pretty intriguing, and I was kind of curious. The framework of the story is about Alma Warren, who's an artist who's getting ready to do this big exhibit. And one of the things is that her little brother had almost died when he was three or four, I think, from choking on a cough drop or a candy or something. So we start hearing all these things about the family throughout this strange little history, and the fact that Northampton also has this other level, this sort of other metaphysical level, where there are these angel-type characters called the Builders, who sort of dictate the fates of assorted key people in the city. The second part is, the second book is called Mansoul, and it's effectively the story of what happened to Michael when he choked on this cough drop, and he basically had this trip through the various metaphysical layers of existence. And that was really good. That's the only part that's basically one ongoing cohesive story. And that was really, really good. I cannot express how much fun that was, to the point where I was really hoping. It had a lot of feel like, felt a little bit like kind of Tom Strong-ish, and the fact that Tom Strong was this big super science guy, but he kept coming in encountering these things that were clearly not scientific as antagonists. And then the third part of the book is called Vernal's Inquest, and it goes back to the various histories and all these threads that start tying together. And it has this very long chapter which sort of discusses the far future history of the universe as seen by this guy and his granddaughter who were sort of walking through it. And that, once again, going back to the best of theme, reminded me of the issue of Majestic that Alan Moore wrote with Majestic at the End of Time. And if you ever read the outline for Twilight of the Superheroes, which was the miniseries that he never did for DC, which was all about the far future of the DC universe, kind of felt a little bit like that too, but really can't draw point to point comparisons. I thought the book kind of petered out near the end. It was certainly enough to keep you interested all the way through it. There was some great, there's a one chapter that's all written as a chapter about, it is about James Joyce's daughter, who's in a sanitarium, Lucia, and the entire chapter, about 6,000 words, is all written in the style of Finnegan's Wake. So have fun getting through that. And there's one chapter that's all basically a very long sonnet, and other chapters are told from some oddball points of view. And once again, one thing that he doesn't get enough credit for is the fact that he's very good at doing voices. He really captures the voices of various people from various points in time and cultures. But it was good. I thought the middle of the book was far more interesting than the end, and it didn't really come off as profound as a lot of the hype made it out to be. But it is definitely worth reading. He every single line is carrying a degree of weight. So much of the story is characters walking around Northampton looking at various buildings and remembering things that happened in those buildings, and a lot of those little tiny granular details sort of start painting this almost pointillistic background bit of world building throughout the entire thing. And that was the part that really fascinated me, is the fact that he was punching out one layer after another during the course of the story. But once again, pretty good. There's a lot of symbolism involving different architecture in Northampton, and a lot of discussion of England in general. But I did really, really like it. And we've mentioned before, John Colpart did a spectacular map of Northampton, which is featured in the book. And which is also very helpful when you're following characters walking around the course of the place, having an idea of what it is that they're doing and where it is they're heading, and what parts of the town are historically more significant than others. But yeah, it was good. I did like it. So I don't think I picked up another book though for days after finishing it. So.
Well, for me, or are you finished, Jeff? Or
okay. Yep, that's it.
As previously mentioned, the past couple of months have been kind of crazy for me, so I'm probably not going to hit 60 books for the year, which is unbroken for decades. I've done always at least 60 books, so I'll be happy if I get the 50. I'll be happy if I get the 45 at this point. So, books read, the only two that I've finished since last episode was the Mobius book, as mentioned, and then I reread, just to be able to read something short and finish it, reread The Dying Earth by Jack Vance, which brought back a lot of memories, because the first time I read those first two, the first two books in that series was in a... rather difficult period of life where my car kept breaking down and I would have to like walk 8 or 10 miles home from work, because I would like work at night. Somebody would drive me there, but I would walk home. I would read in the read along the deserted roads of Piscataway, New Jersey. And both The Dying Earth and The Eyes of the Overworld were read during those walks. So for some reason, whenever I reread these books, I think of that stretch of landscape. But, Jack Vance, his language is wonderful. The stories are fun. I mean, some of the side characters, Chun the Unavoidable. I mean, who can't love someone with a name like Chun the Unavoidable? And this time through, I mean, the one character, I forget which character it is. I think it's the last story. So Sarum, I think is the character, goes on this quest. Mm-hmm. In one of the cities they go through, there's two groups of people that are living there that basically can't see each other. And it's like two parallels, yeah. Two parallel stories, or two parallel societies, rather. And wasn't there a China Mieville book with sort of a same theme?
Yes, City in the City.
Okay, that's the one. Yep. I was like, kept saying, I've read this sort of thing somewhere before. What was it? And then I was like thinking it was him. So there you go. So that's it on books. I might complete a few more before the end of the year, but it's really been when you work on Thanksgiving and you work on weekends and you work from 7:45 until after 8 o'clock at night, 7:45 in the morning till after 8 o'clock at night for weeks on end, then you kind of lose the interest in reading. Short stories, I'm up to 323, and I'm hoping to hit 365. It looks like I should hit that. And then graphical works, I think I've read like 333 titles this year. So again, that's kind of where my brain energy is. And recommending once again, like The Black Monday Murders is a title that I've really liked. We mentioned Warren Ellis, so Trees and Injection. Although I wish he would come out with more installments of both a little faster. And then Anthony Johnson, the one series I really like is The Fuse, which if you're fans of The Expanse or similar kind of near future kind of stuff, I mean, I really recommend that title. That's a really solid favorite of mine. And one that is not genre and which finished recently was The Sheriff of Babylon. That was also a very good title. So I'm going to definitely look for more stuff from that guy. And that's it for me.
Cool.
So,
all right.
That brings us, ladies and gentlemen, to the end of 2016. I'm not quite sure where we're going in 2017, but we will be back. So say goodnight, everyone. Jeff?
Goodnight, everyone.
Everyone.
Okay. And goodbye.